Hi, welcome back to another episode of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies with me, Lisa Schmeiser.
And I am non-Lisa.
What is your name?
Philip Michaels. Hello.
I think I'd know that.
Yeah, you would. Should I wear a name tag next time?
Should I embroider it on your pajamas?
Yeah.
I think it's the premise of a movie, actually.
No, that would be. That would be styling.
I like the idea. Would front breast pocket?
Yeah, I'd sort of like it across the chest, like a sports jersey.
Like a gang tattoo?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one of those things.
That's me.
We can embroider. Anyway, this is Philip Michaels and his bourbon. And before we kick into this exciting episode, which features seven trailers in honor of the Magnificent Seven, we've got some great news for you guys. Many listeners have been asking for a way to support our podcast, and now there is one. Unfortunately, it does not involve a comprehensive overhaul of liquor shipping laws in the U.S.
Yeah, so, thanks, Obama.
So you still can't send us handles of bourbon directly. However, The Incomparable has a backup plan. There's a membership system now that lets you sign up for monthly or annual pledges to support our podcast directly. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up for a membership. You'll then be asked to pick the shows on the Incomparable Network you'd like to support.
So if there are other shows that I listen to on the network, that show where those guys do that thing about the geek stuff, I can
like how you narrowed
one.
It down to just the one show about the guys who
exactly.
do
exactly and the show where there's the guy and the gal and they do the thing too.
They do the talking,
so I can give them the money.
There might be a show about TV.
Yes, the show about that TV program I'm very fond of.
Yeah, there's just one.
Yeah, just the one. Any of those shows you can donate to.
You can check the box for the podcast you'd like to support, up to and including Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. If you check just the box for Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, your entire contribution comes to us.
That would be the wisest choice.
Well, you know, some fees are taken out because Jason does do a great job with this. But, you know, check the box.
We'll
get more bourbon. More bourbon means more podcasts. I'm just saying, there's a cause-effect relationship here. But, again,
Daddy needs his funny juice. Come on.
If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can check their boxes. Your contribution will be shared equally by all shows you want to support. There are contribution levels at $5 a month, $10 a month, and $20 a month.
Those are very reasonable rates. You do not have to be a crazy millionaire who drives up in your limousine with your big comical sack of money with a little dollar sign painted on the front.
Although, if you are, we'd like to meet you.
Yeah.
Any hoodle, you can do it at a monthly rate, or there's the annual subscription for those of you who would rather just pay one lump sum a year, stick a reminder in your calendar, and take care of all your family business on one day. And as a thank you for supporting us, members receive extras like bonus audio tracks, a live bootleg feed of The Incomparable, other cool stuff. I hasten to add, anybody who supports us at the top level, $20 per month, anybody who dedicates $20 per month to Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies will get the option of having us ruin the movie of your choice on a future podcast.
Did you like that burnt episode? Well, boy, you can call the tune. You're the fiddler.
It should make you feel very powerful, knowing that for a scant $240 per year, you can make two grown adults watch whatever you want them to watch.
It is the golden rule, in that him that gots the gold makes the rules.
Anyway, again, it's at theincomparable.com/members. Please consider supporting the network if you've enjoyed the podcast, and thanks in advance. Now that all that.
Yeah, let's not make this like a PBS thing where I hope you're enjoying Ken Burns' documentary on
documentaries
and
on the documentary.
If you enjoy this or any of the other Ken Burns documentaries that we've been showing, we're going to keep talking until we get the money. Big Bird is in a safe house right now, and he wants to go home. We're making
the Muppet Stitch tote bags.
Anyhow,
I like the idea of Elmo in a sweatshop. Elmo's so tired. Keep sewing, Elmo.
These have to be in Hong Kong by 5 a.m.
Those WBUR tote bags don't sew themselves, you little...
Elmo wants freedom.
Well, Elmo, perhaps if someone calls in at the highest level.
Oh, please save Elmo. Elmo's bones are brittle.
Okay.
Well, Elmo, maybe we'll give you a glass of milk.
So, speaking of dystopian scenarios, Phil, let's move on to our movie trailers.
Yeah, let's.
So, which dystopian trailer would you like to hit first? Would you like to hit Sausage Party?
Let's do that.
So last night I went to see pop star Never Stop Never Stopping with the Andy Samberg vehicle at Lonely Island.
She went alone, listeners.
Yeah, Phil did not go.
Well, no,
with
she
me.
Went with she went was, with like-minded chums.
Yes, people whose partners would never set foot in see that.
I sat at home and I read some Proust.
You did.
Yes.
Because you didn't watch Station...
Ice Station Zebra.
No, you didn't watch that.
No, not at all. All 8,000
Anyway,
hours.
The thing that was the most remarkable about going to see this movie was, in fact, the half-hour trailers that preceded it. And some of them were so memorable that I actually ended up breaking the movie theater rule and texting you.
Yep.
And the first one, and the one I made you watch when we got home, mm-hmm. was Sausage Party.
Yeah.
Now, Phil, do you want to explain to our audience what Sausage Party is about, or shall I do it?
I think it is about the fact that Seth Rogen and his friends have way too much creative power and studio executives who will greenlight anything that they propose, and also that marijuana is a hell of a drug. But you take it from there.
Yeah, this is absolutely the movie that got made because somebody got super stoned and went, what if these baby carrots had feelings?
What if food could talk, man?
Then they wrote a movie treatment about it. From the trailer, which is basically food cursing when they find out they're about to be eaten, we're not going to get a nuanced look at food politics in the U.S.
No.
or anything along those lines. It's basically, isn't it funny when hot dogs say the F-bomb? The animation is deliberately amateurish. The voices are kind of predictable at this point. I get the feeling it's sort of like the movie This Is the End, except, you know, with hot dogs.
Yeah, and it's basically, hey, all of our friends, let's go hang out at a voiceover studio for a weekend and riff on what would happen if we were being eaten.
And the thing is, I did see This Is the End, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
There are parts of that movie that are very funny. There are some inspired bits, and it's always a pleasure to... I'm actually kind of a big fan of studios and companies in the sense that actors who have an easy rapport, and part of the pleasure is watching the pleasure they take in working with each other or playing to each other's strengths.
Well, that's the entire appeal of the Ocean's 11 trilogy that Steven Soderbergh did. That it was, with the exception of Julia Roberts, people who liked working with each other.
Everybody looked like everybody. Or there was the movie that we used, The Imposters. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
1999. Because it's all basically a bunch of New York actor friends who got together and made
a
movie.
Let's make a movie
and together. It's 1999. It stars Oliver Platt and Stanley Tucci as two down-at-the-heel entertainers who accidentally end up on a cruise ship. Throw in Lily Taylor, Allison Janney,
Steve Buscemi,
Tony Shalhoub,
Stanley
Hope Davis.
Tucci, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, Hope Davis.
You mentioned him.
Hope Davis is a suicidal debutante, and there's a sabotage plot. But the point is, all of these actors had known each other and worked together in various iterations before. They're having a great time, and it shows.
Yeah.
And so you know, I recommend that. There's like you said, there's the Ocean's 11 movie, and you know, Rogan's kind of got his own coterie going on too.
Yeah, and it's and some of his movies are good, and some are super bad. Is all right.
Yeah,
and like you say, This Is the End is all right. Did not care for Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
Really hated that movie actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it works as a crummy animation thing. I'm just
glad it's rated R because you
don't
can't...
see that the joke is sustainable for 90 minutes.
Well, I'm glad it's rated R because. Children are already picky eaters, and I just imagine if you took a kid to this, they'd never eat again. It's bad enough that kids are like, oh, animals have thoughts and feelings and complex in their lives, and you're like, no, most people don't even have thoughts and feelings and complex in their lives. Don't go ascribing existential crises to bunnies.
Yeah.
Like, that's a thing that happens in children's media, and it drives me bonkers.
There's a very terrible movie called Food Fight, which they talked about on the Flophouse podcast, which is, again, what if food had thoughts and dreams and hopes this sounds like someone saw that and decided, well, if we just threw a bit more money at it, we can make ourselves a hell of a movie.
Anyway, it was something where you're like, really, this is the most dispiriting thing. Well, there were a few dispiriting things about watching Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping, but the trailers were by far the most dispiriting part because you're like, all right, this is the opinion the studio has of me as the audience.
You like crap.
It's
so
not.
Here's some more crap for you.
Oh my God, it was a half hour. Again, I want to stress a half hour of previews. And while the premise of this entire podcast is let's judge a movie based on the preview. I paid $12 to get commercials screamed at me for half an hour. Which
clearly,
is just
you value neither your time or money because you're watching an Andy Samberg film. So I keep wanting to call him Adam Sandler.
Well, no, there's differences.
I know.
Yeah, for one thing,
for
he's
now.
A feminist. No, he's a feminist.
Well, that's true.
Like, he and his the other two members of Lonely Island are actually quite vocal in interviews about it, where they're like, no, we were just raised as actual thinking, feeling human beings in Berkeley, and we were completely shocked that it's not like this in the rest of the world.
Mm.
And I appreciate having men who are out there who are willing to say that they're feminist, and one of the things I can say to pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping is there's no overtly misogynist humor in it.
And that's good.
And a lot of this misogynist posturing they have, like there's a song about, I want you to me like we Saddam Hussein. They're sending up the ridiculous over the top.
Yeah, they're successfully or unsuccessfully?
Successfully.
Okay, parodying
the
prevailing attitude.
Of women as decoration and all that. It's refreshing, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, even when they're talking with each other, there's no dialogue in there that's derogatory towards women or based on the premise that, oh, men will be men and they hate women unless they want something from them. You know, so it's kind of refreshing to have a movie that almost feels like a safe space.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm going to say about that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But the trailers.
So there was that one. The other trailer I saw last night that I made you watch is Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Yes.
And
who are the talking meat puppets that are starring in this?
It's that twink from the High School Musicals.
Is it Zac Efron?
Yeah, that's okay. Who it is. And that dude who was the Manny on Modern Family before we stopped watching it, and he's also in Workaholics.
He's all grown up now.
Yeah. Oh, he's been in the Pitch Perfect movies too,
no.
And I'm guessing he has.
There, you've lost me.
Well, any hoodle the long. Maybe that's how the casting. So anyway, these two dudes are inseparable party jerks, and mm-hmm. they are banned from their sister's wedding unless they can bring nice girls. Because as everybody knows, it's the job of the woman to domesticate a man and make him act like a civilized human being. Of course, this gambit to find nice girls backfires when two women who are apparently even bigger, more crass party monsters than they are.
Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza.
Who are best friends in real life.
Oh, good.
The two women dupe the poor, hapless party boys into taking them to Hawaii for free, and then they spend
they
outbrow each other.
Yeah.
Like, this movie comes off as if it was written by somebody who saw who read the Cool Girl monologue in Gone Girl and went, life goals! Like, it's literally, I get the feeling that the whole premise is, isn't it funny when girls turn to be more crass and boorish than men, but
this is the trope now in cinema. We've had lad cinema for the past
and now it's ladette.
Decade,
yeah.
And now it's, we'll put it on its ear by making the women act terrible, because that is a current Zac Efron movie that's in the theaters now, Neighbors 2. That's apparently the entire gender-bending
Is that you've got
theme.
Chloe Grace Moretz, who specializes in these roles between the Kick-Ass movies and her role on 30 Rock, and now this. Apparently Chloe Grace Moretz's job is to be the girl with the angel face and the potty mouth. Which, you know, mind that genre. Good for you. Go for it while you can sell it. I'm curious to see what comes next.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie, it's just, it feels stale already. Anna Kendrick is very funny, and I don't doubt that she'll be great in her scenes. Aubrey Plaza, it's nice to see that she has more than one default expression, because the Parks and Rec certainly didn't do that for her.
Right.
But I'm not sure. Again, like I said, this movie comes off like somebody who read the Cool Girl monologue from Gone Girl and was like, life goals. And isn't it funny when women misbehave because they're not supposed to do that? And I don't.
What if we took the Wedding Crashers, but we made them women?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't really see how that's particularly progressive, because the whole point to the comedy is, oh, they're not doing what's expected of them. And that's inherently anti-feminist. So.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was boring, it was dumb, it was witless. It was an August release. It will be out earlier, but it feels like it should come out in August.
Basically when we're all tired of movies, but still
actually
don't know how to spend our time.
And continuing the dystopian theme, the third trailer I want to talk about is War Dogs.
Oh God, this is such an uncomfortable trailer.
So we watched, the premise behind War Dogs is Miles Teller and Jonah Hill play.
Now call Miles Teller by the name that you typically call him.
The eminently slappable Miles?
Yes. The eminently slappable Miles Teller.
Oh, God, his face just looks like it's asking for it. Just, every time I see him, I can feel my hands start to itch.
Yeah, you literally start making a fist.
Yeah.
and start like, white knuckling it. You begin to twitch in the face.
It's the hand rises of its own volition. It's like it's possessed.
I think we're going to start calling Miles Teller old slappy. Just to save time.
I feel like the eminently slappable Miles Teller works for me.
Yeah, well, J.K. Simmons would agree with you from what I've seen of Whiplash.
Maybe this is why Whiplash was
the casting director of Whiplash said he walked in the door and they said, "Stop drilling, baby. You've got oil."
Anyway, you know, Smug and Smugger get themselves. Yeah.
And I just want to say, we're making fun of Miles Teller for being punchable.
Yeah, well, yeah.
In this trailer, I thought Jonah Hill was going to die. I thought Jonah Hill was going... Oh, man.
So I feel... So here's the thing is, when Jonah Hill dropped all of that weight, it was kind of unnerving because you were like, no, this doesn't look natural on your body. You look drawn. You look like you're existing on kale. And Anne Hathaway would even tell you to cool it. And this is a woman who spent like a year starving herself for Les Miserables.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really hard when you have an image-oriented occupation.
Yes.
And you still have the biological need to eat and drink. I think it's very hard to moderate.
Oh, sure.
And to to get to a point where you're happy and you're comfortable with your appearance.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't know, because I haven't read much about this movie, we don't know if he was asked to gain weight.
It could have been part of the role, yes, that's true.
In which case seems extraordinarily cruel, because again, he spent a lot of time.
And it looks like he is just sweating Crisco.
It looks like his knees are about to go.
Yeah.
So
anyhow, the movie itself.
The point is that these two, Smug and Smugger, managed to get an arms deal from the U.S. Pentagon, and it basically, the entire trailer is an homage to both Goodfellas and, what am I thinking of? This town needs me to shoot it up and say hello to my little friend.
Oh, Scarface.
Thank you. Yes, that. Yeah, there's like a... Well, I don't want
to... Welcome to Movie Password.
I don't want to finish the whole "this town is up" because it's a terrible line.
Okay. Yeah.
So, anyway, the point is there's a lot of homage to the male id unleashing itself through firearms.
There's a lot of homage to better movies.
And swag, and swaggering, and they're dangerous, and clearly the whole thing is, they got intoxicated by the money, the power, and it's all going to go pear-shaped for them because Bradley Cooper shows up two-thirds of the way through the trailer wearing mirrored sunglasses and looking angry.
So,
And when I watched this trailer in the theater last night, it was just this big, dumb, loud, assaultive thing. At the end of it, I blurted out shocked, "My God, this is white privilege, the white male privilege, the movie," and people around me started laughing and applauding.
So here
it is white male privilege.
I think we should mention the director of it is the man, as the trailer says, from the people who brought you the Hangover trilogy.
Like it's the Krzysztof Krasowski Colors trilogy, red, white, and blue.
Because the second and third movies of the Hangover trilogy were really ones you want to hang your hat on.
Yeah.
There's probably a wonderful dark satire to be made about the arms industry.
Yeah.
I don't really trust the Hangover guy to do it.
No, it's going to be a celebration, again, of white male idiocy.
Yeah, and it's going to be... with enough jokes thrown at sea, we're taking it seriously.
And, you know, women will be used as decoration, mm-hmm. and the whole thing will be, they're just as craven and materialistic as the men, so really, water finds its own level. And, I think it's great that multiple directors have clasped Bradley Cooper to their breast as a muse, because there's the David O. Russell relationship.
Sure.
Clearly, the Hangover dudes like him, because he shows up as an actual grown-up in this movie. But again, this entire movie comes off. It is really difficult in 2016 when you are seeing images of, you know, Syrian refugees drowning, when you are seeing hospitals run by Doctors Without Borders being bombed to smithereens, when you are seeing the carnage and suffering that is the result of 15 years of unmitigated war. It is really difficult to be like, look, some white dudes had a caper with money and guns. You know, it's the wrong treatment at the wrong time. It's facile, and
there's a lot of bad movies about arms dealers over the years, whether it's Sale of the Century with Dudley Moore and Eddie Murphy has a very small role in it, and it came out right after Beverly Hills Cop, and tried to promote it as, Eddie Murphy is in this movie a lot! No, and he's not.
Yeah.
So that was a terrible movie. There was Deal of the Century with Chevy Chase and Gregory Hines and Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah.
There was that terrible Nicolas Cage movie. I know, narrow it down.
Wait, what?
God of War. Gods of War.
Yeah.
Yeah. like I said, there's a good movie to be made.
Look,
where you really hold up a mirror to society and really do a dark funhouse movie satire of,
honestly, like
war profiteering.
Because like the best, we saw that HBO series last year. I'm blanking on the name of it.
But
it's Ziggy from season 2 of The Wire.
Uh-huh.
And
the Brink.
Yes, The Brink. And The Brink actually does a really good job of taking a look at the people who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo because it benefits them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the closest we've gotten.
Yeah.
I won't say it's a problem with The Hurt Locker because The Hurt Locker is a very good movie, but the zip in that movie comes from when they run into Ralph Fiennes and you realize that Ralph Fiennes is a war junkie.
Yeah.
And the 10 minutes of sly commentary on people who thrive in a war zone are cutting. And I would like to see 90 minutes of that where it isn't just, oh, shocked, spoiled Americans go overseas and discover that sand and violence are a thing. I'd like to see a more cutting and incisive treatment.
And
this is not going
to
be it.
No, I don't want to show a lack of faith in The Hangover guy,
this is not going to be The Big Short of the Middle East.
No.
Because I know everyone's like, oh, Adam McKay, The Big Short, herf-derf, and that turned out to pleasantly surprise us all.
Some people didn't like it.
Yeah, but to be fair, also, one of the things that Adam McKay has also gone on the record with a lot of his Will Ferrell stuff, is they're like, no, every one of our movies is about unearned hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And just because we use them with dumb jokes doesn't mean they're not about that. The Hangover movies have never been about anything other than celebrating witless male excess.
The first movie had hints of undercutting lad culture in it.
Yeah.
It had hints of it.
Yeah.
I think, given the direction that the second movie and the third movie took, that was by accident.
Yeah.
Not by design.
It was entirely by accident.
So,
I said, I find the Hangover movies incredibly implausible because nobody likes Justin Bartha enough to go to that much trouble for him.
Oh, poor Miles Teller and Justin Bartha are just, they're sitting at home going, why? Why do you hate us?
Yeah, they can sit next to Daniel Brühl, who's like, why is Shelley now bothering to remember my name?
Justin Bartha and Miles Teller can make a movie called Slappable. You would camp out overnight to watch that.
Are you kidding me? The problem is the camera would slide right off of Justin Bartha. He's that forgettable. Like, you could make a movie about the meaning of nothingness starring him.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
The best thing to happen to Justin Theroux was Justin Bartha, because now there's a more forgettable Justin.
Wow! Holy God! Does he owe you money?
He's perfectly inoffensive, I'm just saying. I don't buy this is actually a critical weakness of all three Hangover films, is we never get a reason why we should bother with this guy.
Okay.
Like, they never demonstrate how he's a vital part of the wolf pack's dynamic. They never demonstrate the value he has to anybody else. He
provides neither milk nor meat nor fur.
he is the suitcase with a light bulb. That is it. You could replace him with a suitcase and a light bulb and the movie would mean the same thing.
Okay.
And it'd be more interesting if a woman was marrying with a suitcase and a light bulb at the end of the first one.
Yeah, that would be a real, really sly commentary about
marriage.
About marriage and heteronormative relationships.
Yeah, how the groom is really unnecessary to these things anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so moving on.
So War Dogs, I think that's done and dusted.
White male privilege, the movie. All right, so Phil, if you remember the reason we started this whole bleeping
the Rosetta Stone of this podcast, as it were.
The thing that started it all was when I wouldn't shut up about
The Purge.
No, it was like The Purge Anarchy. It was like
No, it was the first Purge movie.
Okay.
It was the first Purge movie. We did it, we timed it to the second Purge movie. Yeah. There has since been a third Purge movie, and now there will be
a fourth
Purge movie.
Called The Purge Election.
Because there are so many unanswered questions from the first Purge movie, which is, how in the hell is this a movie?
Yeah.
Go back and listen to the first episode. We won't recap all the
Phil and Lisa ruin their own podcast. This becomes like an Ouroboros of eating its own content. Yeah. Anyway, we also saw the trailer for The Purge Election Year.
The Purge colon.
Election year. So I have to say, first of all, it's nice to see Frank Grillo playing a good guy. He played a bad guy in Captain America: The Winter Soldier. Because he plays
one of the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, yes?
He's the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who goes bad and then becomes a freelance mercenary, and his name is Brock Rumslow, which means, of course, he's a bad guy, so the name Rumslow is just terrible.
Hmm.
And he gets blowed up, and that starts the whole chain of events that starts off all of the Civil War movie.
Okay.
And we can get to that once we get into the movies we've seen segment of things. But anyway, Frank Grillo has a magnificent tough guy presentation on screen. He's got tremendous physicality. I'm honestly shocked that, well, actually, it is a pity that he was so good as Brock Rumslow in the Captain America stuff, because he would have been a great Punisher on Daredevil this past season. John Berthal is great, and I enjoy him. I'm glad they're giving him his own series. Frank Grillo would have been just as good. Frank Grillo has become the pillar of the Purge movies. He is the action hero who has a code, and it's actually somewhat moral, and he manages to make it out by dint of being able to tolerate more pain than humans actually can, and being relentlessly focused and taking care of those who are weaker.
There are recurring characters in the Purge movies?
There are. Frank Grillo is your recurring character, because Frank Grillo has made it through.
You're saying is that you cannot watch The Purge : Election Year without having seen the other Purge movies.
Or, like, read the summaries on moviespoilers.com.
Okay.
Anywho, in The Purge : Election Year, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Mitchell, not to be confused with the children's singer, but is the actual...
It would be better if she were.
Oh my God.
The sun comes up. Kill her! It's the Purge!
The flowers bloom.
I said kill her!
The rain comes down.
No jury will convict us!
The flowers
She's doing
bloom.
Folk music!
This is spoken like a man who's had to listen to his daughter's favorite CDs a few times.
Actually,
her stuff is good.
Thank God it wasn't Rafi.
Yeah.
Now, there would be one I would support The Purge for.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rafi.
Anyway, Elizabeth Mitchell, formerly...
Miles Teller can comfort you now.
No, I will take Rafi over Miles Teller every day of the week and twice on Sundays.
Well, sure.
Anyway, Elizabeth Mitchell, who used to be on Lost, is a senator who, we are given to understand from the trailer, has a tragic backstory with The Purge.
Mm-hmm.
And she has since become... a senator. She's a bold, outspoken woman who talks about wanting to eradicate policies that are discriminatory and predatory towards the poor and minorities.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a popular woman politician who's a populist, voice of the people, speaks out for the disadvantaged. Naturally, a cabal of white dudes decides that she has to be killed for her sins.
And it is literally a room full of shadowy white dudes going, she must be killed for her.
Yeah. She must, we have to
we're,
take
We're going to put an end to this.
Right. So her Purge security is breached, of course. Frank Grillo has to save her. And he is assisted in this endeavor by a veritable rainbow coalition of people, none of whom are white males.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched this trailer, after going, oh, Jesus, because we're on movie number 4, the second thing I thought was, all right, there's somebody in that writer's room who was, like, camping in a tent in Occupy for, like, 2 months and probably gives to Elizabeth Warren campaign and has decided that their contribution to the public discourse in this highly, I wouldn't even say inflammatory, in this highly fraught election year. You know what I'm going to do to elevate...
I'm writing a Purge movie to elevate the debate.
Yeah, because what if Elizabeth Warren were chased through the street by Trump supporters? Like, that's basically the movie.
Wearing masks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's your movie, and it's violent and bloody and baroque, and it suffers from the horror movie sequelitis, where the first horror movie is always great because it's pared down and visceral. Like, the premise is really simple, and it's executed beautifully, and then subsequent horror movies are always more and more elaborate, and you're like, what the actual heck?
Well, the horror movie sequels are become like concerts for bands that peaked 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Where it's, now we're going to play our hit record! Yeah. And everyone, yay, all right.
Yeah.
They played...
And now we're going to play our hit record with fireworks going off.
Yeah.
And women dance in the background.
They played When the Lights Are Going Down in the City. Woo, good. Thanks, Steve Perry.
Yeah. That's the problem with horror movies, is you can't take the simplicity and shock of the premise and replicate it. You have to add stuff to it.
Yeah,
I think you are
probably injecting far more social relevance into the Purge: Election Year.
I'm doing the theory mostly tongue-in-cheek, but I can't help but notice the parallels, and I'm convinced the parallels are what sold it, where they're like, we're going to show a lady politician, and there's going to be a cabal of white dudes who want to keep things the way they were, and we're going to point out the explicit oppression of the poor, and it's going to resonate. That was probably someone's thinking.
again, I question the idea that the Purge colon election year is uh-huh. is a Trojan horse of progressive thought.
You know, you put it that way and it does sound crazy.
The Purge colon election year brought to you by the Utney Reader. Hello, friends.
Oh my God. Quinoa kills everything.
Michael Lerner pops out and goes, you know, we've had a lot of fun here talking about the Purge.
Oh my
but let's
God.
Talk about education policy.
Now all of a sudden it's the forum with, mm-hmm. oh God.
I can't. Saul.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah, but we're now devolving into Bay Area Public Radio.
Yeah, exactly. No one needs to know what
KQED. Yeah, I mean, it'd be fun. I think it would be funny if it turns out the Purge is unexpectedly like a progressive Trojan horse. I'm just saying that I think it's a mark. I think that the mark.
Hey, yo, this is Red Skull. You know.
We've killed a lot of people.
We've killed a lot of people here tonight, but you know what's really killing people? Economic inequality.
The suicide rate among white women has never been higher. Men are dying younger.
You work two jobs, but you don't get ahead.
No. And when it's the Red Skull saying that, it's even funnier because he's a big redhead.
He's a big redhead. He points at his head as he's saying that.
Oh my God.
That's his laugh line. And people go, ha, Red Skull, you made us think and laugh.
I'm pretty sure Progressive Red Skull is going to have to be your Halloween costume this year.
Yeah, I think so.
So anyway, the Purge election year is coming out on July 4th, of course.
Yeah.
Because nothing says America like that.
Yeah, run, don't walk.
Yeah. Or opposite direction.
Or don't go see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which would probably be the better course of action.
Yeah, so shall we move to something a little less...
a little less
dumb culture.
Well.
And into something a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Magnificent Seven.
They are remaking the Magnificent Seven into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you watch the Magnificent Seven movie, you go, hey, I wish they would remake it with people I like instead of dead guys.
Instead of Yul Brynner.
Yeah, instead of Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
What if we took Steve McQueen and replaced him with Chris Pratt?
Yeah. So it's got a murderer's row of people.
Yeah.
Because it's got Denzel Washington.
Yep.
And Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
Who, they seem to, the trailer that I saw, you've got the ageless Denzel Washington, who has now moved into this steely moral ambiguity portion of his career,
mm-hmm.
which I approve of. And you have Chris Pratt, who's talking about how this can't possibly be too hard. And unfortunately, it's the same cocksure attitude he brought to Jurassic World.
Yeah.
So I'm just waiting for a bunch of cowboys to fight raptors.
Yeah. We sort of covered this in the Ben-Hur episode, that I don't think remakes are inherently a bad thing, especially when Magnificent Seven, the one that I love from the 1960s, is mm-hmm. in fact a remake of The Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
But if you're going to remake a movie, have something original and new to do, and... a Rocky version of House of the Rising Sun playing over the trailer doesn't fill me with a lot of hope that they've really that they've really thought this thing out. Where
I sort of feel like the rock and roll version of the House of the Rising Sun is to movie trailers right now what Baba O'Reilly was back in the late 90s.
Yeah, sure.
Where it's you every time you hear it, like, okay, now I'm supposed to be blown over by the Penelope of life and oh, great and wondrous emotional roller coaster. And now when you hear the rock and roll version of the House of the Rising Sun, you're like, oh, good. Lots of problematic moral things are going on, and also there will be sex and mm-hmm. violence. Hooray.
Yeah.
Like that song, just I have it that's strongly associated by this point.
It could well be a good movie.
Yeah.
But I feel that when you remake a movie and mm-hmm. use the title, you invite comparisons, and usually the comparison is wanting. Really, the only problematic thing about the original Magnificent Seven is Horst Buchholz,
mm-hmm.
Who is quite terrible. He plays the young Mexican, a man named Horst Buchholz,
playing a Mexican
who joins the Magnificent Seven. Is farmers. Ugh, farmers! I hate them so!
Well, this time they've got... It's a small world, because they've got, you know...
Yeah.
They've got a First Nations dude, and they've got Denzel, of course,
mm-hmm.
and then they've also got... Byung Hung Lee, because the West was known for nothing if not its eager embrace of the martial arts,
mm-hmm.
and they've got Chris Pratt playing your usual cowboy dude, and we've got Vincent D'Onofrio in this.
Yeah,
so there's that. And
foreshadowing.
Yes. Note that.
It could be okay. It probably won't be. Just watch the original. The original is really good.
Yeah.
It's fun. Eli Wallach's in it as the bad guy. It has some memorable lines.
Eli Wallach is awesome.
Steve McQueen is in it, and it's Steve McQueen being the most minimal actor in the history of acting.
He's just riveting in that, though.
But he's great.
I love watching him in that.
And he and Yul Brynner, each one thought the other one was trying to upstage each other, so they would keep doing things to not be upstaged.
Yeah.
And it's great. It works.
And Yul Brynner is just one of a kind. Oh my god, I love him so much.
It's such an iconic role that he reprised it in Westworld as the gunfighter robot.
And he's just so... We've had this talk before about actors versus movie stars.
Although that was still at the point in his career where they had to explain away his accent.
Yeah.
Because there's the line in there, oh, you Cajun, you don't talk so good, but I understand what you're saying.
But the point is we make the distinction between actors and movie stars, and sometimes if you're lucky, you have someone who's both.
Yeah.
See also Jennifer Lawrence or Scarlett Johansson.
Right.
Or I would even argue Denzel Washington.
Oh, sure. No, Denzel Washington can act the hell out of things.
But Yul Brynner is one as well.
Yes.
And just the charisma he had, if you could bottle that crap and sell it on eBay, oh my god.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, it'll be interesting to see how they, I wouldn't mind seeing it in a compare and contrast kind of way, and to see what they've updated for modern sensibilities.
Yeah.
My worry is that when they update it for modern sensibilities, they'll take away a lot of what made the original so good.
Yeah, the original actually has some poignancy. It's not just a chuck and duck western.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's why it sticks with you, is because there's some emotional depth to it.
Mm-hmm.
This preview, I think my complaint was, I get that the Magnificent Seven is largely about, like, two or three people who have, big names on the poster, but if you're talking about the Magnificent Seven, I love a good trailer where they introduce everybody.
Yeah, show me the Seven.
Yeah, who the hell are the Seven at this point? I have no idea. Like, I'm looking at the IMDb list right now, and they have Matt Bomer listed. I'm like, well, who is he playing? Is he just, we had to pick up a handsome man to be the sixth or seventh in this? and Matt Bomer's like, yes, that's me, Twinkle, and because Matt Bomer's very handsome.
Whereas all of the Seven in the original Magnificent Seven, they all have roles to play, they all have parts to play, they all have
Because the Seven Samurai are just like that. I saw that in Castro like 15 years ago, and it has still stuck with me over how beautifully executed it is and how elegantly the parts interlock.
Yeah. No, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I would recommend that.
Yeah,
I would recommend either The Magnificent Seven or The Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
And then if you make it out to the theater to see this one.
Yeah, let us know how it is.
I'll probably see it because I'm a sucker. Mm-hmm. I'm a dummy.
No, you're not.
I'll go see it.
All right. So, yeah, Vincent D'Onofrio is playing someone named Jack Horn, so I'm going to assume you know who that is.
They've related him to Vin Tanner, which is the...
Oh, he was played as...
The Steve McQueen role, but no, that's not... That can't be it.
Vince D'Onofrio is an incredibly talented actor. I've loved him on Daredevil. I can't really see him channeling Steve McQueen.
No, I have to think that whoever did that in IMDb is quite mistaken.
I hope so. I hope so.
If anything, he's going to be playing the Harry role, who's I bet there's gold at this small village that we're defending.
Yeah.
I'll find that gold and I'll steal it and run away. And then he redeems himself at the end before he's shot.
You poor dumb dummy.
Or he can be the Robert Vaughn character, who's the cowardly gunfighter.
Well, perhaps he's a Brazilian immigrant who moves north.
Ah, and that leads us into Pele, Birth of a Legend.
Yeah, you know what? You wanted to talk about two
I wanted to talk about sports movies.
Yeah, so you had a really specific thing you wanted to say about.
Well, because both of these movies have come and gone in theaters, and they're probably either on your on-demand cable right now or on iTunes.
Yeah.
One is Pele, both Birth of a Legend, and the other is Race, which is about Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
Basically, the trailers for both are the sports movie sports trailer, where it's in a time where someone was growing up poor and disenfranchised, they decided that they were going to make something of themselves. I'm going to make something of myself. There were obstacles along the way. You don't belong here. Yes, I do. Okay.
It's usually a white man providing the obstacle.
And they did.
As was accurate.
and they would rise above things and teach us a lesson about race, but not too uncomfortable lesson, because after all, we want everyone to buy tickets for this movie.
Let's not examine too closely why they were oppressed in the first place.
Yeah, so Pele, Birth of a Legend, Pele colon Birth of a Legend is about Pele and the birth of his legend. And
what is his legend? Pele is a soccer player.
He is a soccer player.
Just in case the people who listen to this are so sufficiently esoteric in their interest.
I guess this is the Incomparable Network, so I should explain. Pele played a game.
This is how we get all the pledges, by insulting the listeners.
Pele played a game called soccer. Soccer is a game that features two teams of 11 people trying to kick a ball into a goal. A ball is a spherical object.
Hey, Phil, I have a question. Can you use your hands in soccer?
You cannot use your hands in soccer unless you are the goalie who can use their hands. They're the person who tries to stop the goal from being scored.
Oh.
Any hoodle. Pele.
Pele is known one, for being.
I believe I'm doing math in my head. I want to say 3 World Cups with Brazil. Certainly 2.
Yeah.
And was a
phenomenally acrobatic player.
Phenomenally acrobatic player, transformative player, came to North America towards the end of his career to cash in with the New York Cosmos.
Yeah.
But this is mostly about young Pele winning the World Cup with Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And Vincent D'Onofrio plays the coach of the Brazilian team and apparently suffered a stroke while filming the movie, because that is the only way to explain the Brazilian Portuguese accent he affects when talking to Pele.
It is like listening to Dick Van Dyke do an English accent.
I don't often urge people to watch the trailers that we have watched. Hunt down the trailer for Pele colon Birth of a Legend, and suddenly Vincent D'Onofrio appears and goes, "What you are doing with Santos, you cannot necessarily do." And you're what the hell, Vincent D'Onofrio?
That accent is like a French person had a fight with, and not just a French person, like a Pepe Le Pew accent had a fight with Speedy Gonzalez, and then they ran it through like the Elmer Fudd filter.
Yeah.
It is
an unsupportable accent.
No, it may replace Dick Van Dyke's Mary Poppins accent in the Hall of Fame for things that should not have been allowed to be committed to film.
Yeah.
Or what I like to refer to as a cultural crime.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand why Brazilians have lots of things to write about,
They've got a lot on their mind right now.
Zika virus, the incredible graft and corruption surrounding the Olympics, the fact they have opened to clean up the water,
the coup that actually happened in their
the favelas, the grinding poverty, the environmental degradation.
And yet somehow Vincent D'Onofrio's accent may be worse than all of those things.
Yeah, I know, it's just... And I'm like, how did that happen? Was his coach drunk and having a stroke at the same time?
Yeah, I don't know.
So, anyway...
And there's that, and also Race, which is, again, about Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in the 1980s, there was a two-part miniseries that aired on TV about Jesse Owens, and it was terrible.
Yeah.
No one's ever done a good Jesse Owens movie. Judging by the reviews of this movie, no one has still done a good Jesse Owens
movie. So I have to admit, when I watched this trailer, the minute Jason Sudeikis came on...
Jason Sudeikis, who plays Jesse Owens' coach.
I was waiting for a punchline, because Jason Sudeikis has the kind of face that suggests complete fatuousness.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be fair. I mean, I am somebody who actually paid money to go see We're the Millers and enjoyed it because he was an affable, low-key... He and Jennifer Aniston are, like, perfectly matched that movie, because they're both affable, low-key, moderately funny people who gamely execute a script. But you see him in this as the coach, and you're just like, you look like somebody who would brand a fraternity pledge. You're terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it just... The whole time I was watching the Jesse Owens thing... I thought they've managed to construct a trailer about Jesse Owens that makes him look like a jerkstor.
Yeah.
Because it's basically, oh, Jesse Owens, you
very petulant.
No, not just that, but it's, oh, Jesse Owens, you don't care about the Holocaust, you just care about winning medals. And I'm like, that's a really deeply, historically unfair take on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's an interesting, it's one interpretation.
Look, I have no doubt that it's based off of actual things that happened. And
you could say that.
And, and to be fair, the U.S. did a marvelous job of ignoring the Holocaust while it was going on.
The 1936 Olympics, if you read up on it, it was a very fraught thing.
Yeah.
And the head of the USOC at the time was a fellow named Avery Brundage, who was wasn't a great guy.
No, no.
And well, might have actually sympathized with...
someone associated with the USOC who's corrupt and awful?
Yeah.
No!
And became the head of the IOC.
Of course he
garnered the nickname Slavery Avery because he was very much in favor of the amateur status of Olympians. Not a great dude, but... I would almost watch the movie to see how he's portrayed in it. I assume not well, but that would require me to sit through the rest of Race, which I'm told is not very good.
Well,
and the trailer with its CGI'd stadiums.
It had CGI'd races, and this is, and by races I mean CGI'd athletic bouts and not CGI'd ethnic demarcations.
Mm-hmm.
But this points out, I think, one of the central problems with doing any movie about a seminal athlete is, especially in this day and age, athletes can't act and actors aren't athletes.
Right.
And so if you're making a movie about a subject whose very claim to immortality is a form of highly refined and highly specific physical excellence, there's almost no way to make that as a live-action movie.
They made, when they made Miracle, which is about the 1980 Olympic team, hockey team, for most of the hockey players, they casted people rather, on their basis, can they skate?
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than can they act? And boy, can you tell in the scenes where they're required to act?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't care for that one either. A lot of people like that movie. I don't. I'd rather just watch the damn tape of
And this is the other problem, too, is... Is at this point we have enough footage where if you were going to make, say, the Janet Evans movie, and I'm not sure she's a good subject, I'm just whipping out.
Yeah, you're just picking the name.
Or if you were to make, say, the Nadia Comaneci movie, how would whatever you commit to film be as good or better than what actually happened and what people remember?
Right.
This is why movies about up-and-comers, I think, do better, is because you can see that it's potential that's on its way up, and this is perhaps why movies that are not about sports in a strict sense do okay, but you're never going to be able to make the Babe Diedrichs and Zaharias movie.
Yeah. Well, we're recording this the weekend that Muhammad Ali died.
Yeah.
As I mentioned on Twitter, Don't let anyone convince you in this moment that you should watch the Michael Mann biopic.
No.
Because that is 2 hours and 37 minutes of a not very interesting movie. And how can you make a boring biopic about Muhammad Ali? Well, they succeeded.
Because it's Michael Mann. And what Michael Mann excels at is the machinery of plot and the establishment of mood and a very specific visual vocabulary.
And but that when works it in movies like Heat.
Yeah, and that works in movies like Manhunter.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work
when you're trying to get to the heart of a dude.
A passionate person who was deeply religious and also deeply committed to his conscience?
Yeah.
Michael Mann is exactly the wrong person for the job.
Yeah, so, and it got me thinking, if you were to make your list of transformative athletes of the 20th century, it would be, you know, your Muhammad Ali's, your...
Babe Diedrichs and Zaharias. What do you think about Jim Thorpe?
I would include him. Yeah. I would include Jackie Robinson, certainly. Yeah. I'd include Jesse Owens.
Billie Jean King or Serena Williams?
Certainly.
Or would you include the Williams sisters?
20th century, so no.
Okay, yeah.
And I would also throw Babe Ruth in there just for the influence beyond his sport.
The
cultural influence.
How about Michael Jordan?
No.
No, okay.
No.
You're talking about people who engaged in a wider cultural dialogue.
Right.
And you're right, Jordan didn't, my bad.
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, the reason I'd say Ruth as opposed to Jordan is they're Ruthian is actually
an adjective. Yeah.
And Jordanian is are you describing someone from the country of Jordan? So
no. Also Michael Jordan, the whole point to who was he was an athlete, and that's all we've ever known him as.
And maybe Wilma Rudolph, I'd probably include her as well. But of those people I just mentioned, maybe 42, the recent movie about Jackie Robinson.
Oh, that's such a great movie.
It's okay.
No,
it has some problems.
Nicole Beharie is amazing.
She's great in it.
Yeah. Chadwick Boseman.
Chadwick Boseman is pretty good in it. The main problem I have is Harrison Ford under about 48 pounds of latex doing the, I'm rich, Ricky, and I'm going to... Yeah. Brr, 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 brr.
Well,
that's my big problem with that movie.
I feel like Harrison Ford should... just retire, though. I realize this is probably anathema, if not downright apostasy in some circles, but this is a guy who seems like he's gotten all he's going to get out of the craft of acting, mm-hmm. doesn't enjoy the parts of his job that are not about being in front of a camera, and doesn't seem like he's bringing much to the stuff that he's doing in front of a camera that other people can't do better.
Mm-hmm.
So
42 yeah. is all right.
Husband to Calista. She's doing a great job over on Supergirl.
The Ken Burns documentary about Jackie Robinson is more worth your time.
Yeah.
But 42 is okay. Yeah. Of the Ali stuff, the best mm-hmm. thing about involving Ali ever done was When We Were Kings.
Oh, God, yeah.
Documentary.
I love that.
There is, as we've established, there is really not a good Jesse Owens movie. They're making a Billie Jean King movie.
With Emma Stone as Billie Jean King.
I didn't know she was Asian.
Well, if you can pass as Asian, you can certainly pass as a 40-year-old lesbian.
Well, she was in her 30s, yeah. about the early 30s when they yeah. were at the time. It's about the Bobby Riggs match with yeah. Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs.
Yeah.
That could be okay. I have hope for that one.
I feel like they should.
Look, I wish they would have gotten. She doesn't strike me as a substantive actress in it. It's a part that deserves substance.
You and I still need to see Birdman because she does. She manages to hold her own against Ed Norton in Birdman, which okay. is not easy.
No.
But the again. I think one of the reasons there are a couple reasons you're never going to see movies about transformative female athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is because a lot of the decision makers in Hollywood still genuinely believe that women can't open movies unless it's about how everybody wants to have sex with them.
Yeah.
Number two is going to be that the actresses who are considered profitable or who are like, oh, she could open a movie, they're not athletes. They're not built like athletes. They are basically built like very willowy people with functioning eating disorders. And mm-hmm. athletes have muscles. For example, you're never going to get a movie about the 1992 women's softball team that did so well for the U.S.
I think 96.
Okay. Yeah, but the 96 U.S. women's softball team, phenomenal team. Find me 14 actresses who are able to open a movie who are built like softball players.
Yeah. Convincingly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The only way you could ever get that movie made is if it was going to be put on Logo, and then you could actually cast actresses who played softball.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, and it's the same thing. This is why there's never going to be a good swimming movie, is because an actor can't turn their body into a swimmer's body. It's just not possible.
So, and Babe Ruth is the subject of two of the worst biopics ever made.
Yeah. And the thing is baseball movies should be easy because baseball players don't look like athletes.
No, you can cast John Goodman as Babe Ruth and it should work out okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Except they have him playing young Babe Ruth too.
You could cast Jonah Hill as Babe Ruth.
Yeah, at this point. But no, I actually, if you do have a weakness for bad movies, mm-hmm. do go and see the original Babe Ruth story with William Bendix
Ugh.
As Babe Ruth, because it is yeah. a bad movie.
Yeah.
But, so basically, of the transformative athletes of the 20th century I mentioned, 42 is okay,
yeah.
and the Jim Thorpe story with Burt Lancaster is okay.
You know how I think you could make a movie?
Mm.
A transformative athlete movie is you do something fairly close to what Richard Linklater did in Waking Life, where it's a type of animation that's based on live action,
yeah.
but it's just removed enough where you can put in some magnificent visual effects. And I think that's how you do the sleight of hand that gets you around the fact that actors, and I'm not saying that actors are all tripping over their left foot, I'm just saying that actors and athletes, those are two very different physical skills. And while there's no doubt that actors can work very hard to mimic the moves of an athlete, you can tell the difference.
The movie that I always cite is uh-huh. Fear Strikes Out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a movie about Jim Pearsall, who uh-huh. was a player in the 1950s who mm-hmm. had mental health issues.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I actually was institutionalized for a time.
Mm-hmm.
And for a 1950s movie, it is surprisingly frank about mental health.
Yeah.
And Anthony Perkins plays Jimmy Pearsall.
Oh, God.
Carl Malden plays his abusive father. And it is a great movie right up until the point where they ask Anthony Perkins to do athletic things because he swings the bat and you go, I am out of this movie.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, there's no physical act he could do worse, and then they have him run to first base.
Oh, God.
And, that is not...
Yeah, it's...
Oh, good movie.
Yeah.
Right up until they play baseball in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Anyhow, let's wrap this up with the things that we've watched that we like
yeah.
portion.
I saw Captain America Civil War.
Yes, you did.
Did I talk about that in the last one?
I don't remember.
No, I think I may have gone to see that right after we did that recording.
Yeah, I don't think
so. I saw Captain America Civil War. I get the feeling that I liked it a lot more than a lot of other people did. And I think one of the reasons I liked it so much is because I have a lot of respect for the way the Russo brothers choreograph a fight.
Yeah.
There is an opening. The opening sequence could basically double as a physics final if your professor was pretty sadistic. Physics professors who are listening, take the idea. You're welcome. Send me the recordings of your students crying. They give me strength. But the movie really feels like it's what the Avengers Age of Ultron should have been. The action sequences are bright and sprightly. Black Widow is an actual character who has a lot to do here, where she is the voice of reason, as per usual, and she's super competent, and she is not busy, you know, my ovaries, the whole time, which is nice. They flesh out the Vision and Scarlet Witch, both of whom could just be boring and drippy in the hands of other directors, and they bring in Paul Rudd, and they use him to good effect, too. I mean, sure, the movie is still about handsome Dorito Steve Rogers, you know, running around with his remarkable inverted triangle physique and trying to bring his best friend back from Soviet brainwashing and all that, but they do a great job with the supporting cast. Daniel Bruhl, who you'll notice I'm using his full name, plays the most effective Marvel villain to date. Mm. And he does a great, poignant job with it. And Chadwick Boseman is phenomenal in the movie. Like, he's really one of the breakouts.
Okay.
So I enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. It's still long. Like, all of these movies are too long. Yeah. But I would put it in, I think it's in my top five.
Of Marvel movies.
Yes, there are like so many of them now. I feel confident saying that I could have a top five and this would rank in there.
You could.
It definitely ranks above Age of Ultron for me. It ranks above at least two of the Iron Mans. It is probably on par. Like, the Russo brothers are doing a great job with the Civil War, with the Captain America stuff.
And America series is okay.
I'm excited to see what they're going to do with the two-part Avengers theme that they're filming now.
Okay.
So I saw that. And then, like I said, I saw Pop Star Never Stops Not Stopping. The songs are the best part of the movie there. And
is the fourth best Marvel movie.
Yeah, Pop Stop. But no, I saw the Never Stop, Never Stopping thing last night.
Yeah.
The songs are the best part of that. And there's a lot of squandering of comedic talent.
I'll make mine quick, since we're talking sports movies in this one. I'll recommend one that actually isn't a sports movie, though there's a bike race at the end. I just recently rewatched Breaking Away.
Oh, yeah. And beautiful Dennis Quaid.
With young Dennis Quaid. Oh, just
so dreamy.
As if he has been carved by Michelangelo.
Oh, no kidding. The only mistake they made was keeping the cutoffs on.
That is not why I'm going to recommend the movie. It is a wonderful coming-of-age movie.
Yeah.
If you're a young person, if you're old like me, you'll appreciate Paul Dooley's performance.
That's what I really liked about the movie, because I watch it with you every time you watch
it.
I get sucked into it anyway. Yeah. And what I really enjoyed about this movie is how sensitive and respectful it is towards everybody's state of mind. The generational clash occurs simply because it's people who are very much alike at two very different points in their life. It's not, you olds don't get me, or you youngs are awful.
Yeah.
And I liked that it was about the continuum of experience.
Yep.
And Paul Dooley, as I get older, I'm like, oh, Paul Dooley, you're awesome.
Yeah. A really great movie. I'd recommend that. I also, I'll throw an arabesque in there, which is,
Is it about ballet?
No, it's a, it's a thriller movie where, excuse me, Stanley Donen, who mostly is known as Gene Kelly's collaborator, basically does a Hitchcock movie where Gregory Peck is a professor who is running around trying to solve a mystery involving Egyptians, and Sophia Loren pops in as a
That one.
Yeah,
I kept walking in on that one.
And it has its moments. The ending gets a little bit silly, where at one point they're actually being chased by bad guys riding farming equipment.
This is true.
And you sit there going, come on, wrap this up. And but other than that, it's a really,
it's a B for the way he deploys Sophia Loren.
It's a really, it's a frisky movie. It's a fun watch. So, arabesque, if you have not seen it. Yeah. And Breaking Away, certainly.
Yes.
Run, Don't Walk.
Next time it's on TCM. So, this has turned out to be sort of a supersized episode, but, you know,
too long.
There are a lot of trailers coming up. And I want to remind you, again, if you want to support this podcast, go to the Incomparable comparable.com/members and sign up for membership. There are both monthly and annual options, and the contribution levels for the monthly membership are $5, $10, and $20 per month. If you pledge $20 per month support to Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, we will watch a movie of your choice and ruin it for you in a subscriber-only podcast. Again, you have the opportunity to tell two grown people what they have to watch and then listen to them wail and moan in their reactions. And that kind of power should and can go to your head. So I urge you, sign up, support us at theincomparable.com/members. You can also support several of the other fine podcasts on the Incomparable Network. There are so many that are so great. And we want to thank you for sticking with us with this podcast.
Do you have anything to add to that, Elmo?
Elmo's so cold! Please give Elmo food!
Keep sewing!
Back to your cell, Elmo. Good night, everyone!